This is Mark Strassman, reporter with the Utopia Media Technology News Network. We're about to speak with Stuart Hindle, who is the Vice President for Energy Solutions at AeroVironment and Sky Tower. Welcome to Utopia Media Technology News Network.
Thanks, Mark.
You're the Director of Energy Solutions at AeroVironment Sky Tower. Well, what do you do as Director of Energy Solutions?
Well, for the Sky Tower subsidiary, I'm actually the Vice President of Business Development and Strategy. And so it's typically when AeroVironment develops their various somewhat leading-edge technologies, once they see there's a potential business opportunity, I get involved in helping develop the plans for that business and identifying potential customers and investors to enable that venture.
Okay, let's back up a little then. AeroVironment has developed and supplies a variety of innovative energy and communication solutions. What's the company's overall philosophy? What's it trying to do?
It really covers two areas. In general, the theme is anything where extreme efficiency is important, and that extreme efficiency somehow enables a business opportunity or addresses an industry problem. And that tends to cover two business areas for us. One is our unmanned aircraft businesses, which covers small unmanned hand-deployable aircraft that we're now actually, we being AeroVironment, are now the largest volume supplier of UAVs or unmanned aircraft to the U.S. military, in addition to high-altitude, long-duration aircraft that operate in the stratosphere, which also require extreme efficiency to operate in that kind of regime for weeks to months between landings. And then the other part, business area for AeroVironment, also involving extreme efficiencies, are advanced power systems, whether it's distributed energy or fast charging systems or power processing equipment, where, again, somehow extreme efficiency is an important element of that business solution.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about those different areas that you're in. Tell us first who Paul McCready is, what his role historically, and what his role is now at AeroVironment.
Paul McCready was identified by Time magazine as one of the 100 greatest innovators of the last century, along with Edison and Einstein. So he has a pretty interesting past. What initially put him on the map was in the 70s. He developed the first effective human-powered aircraft, sort of what the Wright brothers did with machine-powered flight. Paul McCready did the same with a human-powered flight with the Gossamer Condor and Albatross and collected aviation prizes for doing so. And that was sort of the start of AeroVironment. To perform human-powered aircraft, you need airframes and propulsion systems are highly lightweight and efficient, and very efficient aerodynamics. And that's also required for solar-powered aircraft. And so those capabilities ultimately enabled us to be successful in solar-powered flight and ultimately operating in the stratosphere. And Paul's interests, though, cover a broad range of areas, again, usually focused on high efficiency. I think the general motto is doing more with less. And an example of that would be the Impact electric vehicle that we developed for General Motors. It was the first modern-day electric vehicle that demonstrated that a modern-day high-performance electric vehicle was viable. And through that partnership with General Motors, it enabled us to develop very highly advanced, lightweight, and efficient propulsion systems and power electronics and controls that ultimately went into our high-altitude aircraft technology as well.
Now, in a way, you sort of have this set of technologies for essentially extreme propulsion capabilities and for very light airframes and so on, and you sort of mix and match them, don't you, and put them in different vehicles and different uses, but it's essentially many of the same the same components that go into many of your systems.
Right.
Isn't that right?
Yeah, there are core building blocks that we apply to each, and as we move forward with these leading edge technologies, it's a matter of demonstrating the feasibility or validating the feasibility of each of these different building blocks. And for instance, with our high-altitude, long-duration aircraft, which enables the Sky Tower telecom business, it started off with developing this highly efficient, lightweight airframe that could operate in the stratosphere. And the Helios airframe, its wingspan is bigger than a jumbo jet, but it weighs less than your car. So it's a very unconventional airframe, extremely lightweight, and can operate on the power of a handful of hair dryers. It takes only about 10 kilowatts of power to keep the aircraft aloft.
Does that, that's a high strength-to-weight ratio, is that based on composite technology?
Right, yeah, heavy use of composite technologies. The initial configurations of that aircraft were purely solar-powered, and so essentially a flying wing covered with high-efficiency solar cells on top. And that enabled us to not only fly in the stratosphere at over 50,000 feet, but actually break multiple altitude records, and it shattered the world altitude record for all aircraft in level flight by flying to almost 97,000 feet.
Now presumably you're upgrading the solar cells there. I interviewed some people from somebody from Powerlight about a week ago. And I've been trying to follow as much as I can some of the research that's going on at Los Alamos National Laboratories about impact ionization and more advances in solar photovoltaic technologies. Are you constantly putting more efficient solar cells into the panels on your stratospheric vehicles?
Yes. I'm not the technical person to go into details, but I can provide you a broad overview.
Right.
Most of our configurations have had silicon-based solar cells on them, but advanced high-efficiency versions. On the last aircraft, we had Sun Power high-efficiency solar cells that were near about 20% efficiency. But ultimately, the kind of solar cell technology that could be used for aircraft are like multi-junction solar cells, which are projected to provide over 30% efficiency in like the mid 30s or so. And with those kind of solar cell efficiencies, it really expands the envelope in which this aircraft can operate. And there are two different primary configurations of this aircraft depending on the latitude.
Why does the latitude matter?
Well, the lower in latitude you are, the more consistent solar availability you have throughout the year.
Meaning closer to the equator.
Right, because the further you get away from the equator in winter, the less solar availability you have.
Right.
And if you can't collect enough solar power during the day, then your airplane can't fly through the night.
Right.
And so one configuration, it's a closed cycle system called a regenerative system. And this is the aircraft configuration that could fly for 6 months or more between landings in the stratosphere. And that has a combined system of a solar array and a fuel cell system in a closed cycle. And it's a pretty elegant system. During the day, excess power from the solar cells are used by an electrolyzer to split onboard water into hydrogen and oxygen.
Right.
Then the fuel cell system recombines that hydrogen and oxygen at night, creating electricity in the process. And so it's a cycle that just repeats itself every day. And theoretically, that cycle could continue forever, but from a practical standpoint, it's difficult to contain hydrogen for extremely long periods of time, and some just leaks out into the atmosphere. And so from a practical standpoint, the airplane would come down roughly every 6 months or so to land.
Dan, have its water changed, sort of?
Right. Just fill up with water and send it back on its way.
Okay.
So it's a very elegant, non-polluting system But it's latitude limited to approximately about 30 degrees latitude or so.
So how far north and how far south does that?
So that would put you just to the edge of the U.S.
The southern edge.
Right. And that configuration, that envelope continues to expand as there are improvements in both fuel cell technologies and solar cell technologies. But there's another configuration, which is an open cycle system, which is called a primary fuel cell system. And that's what's under development right now, because this configuration can operate anywhere in the world. Instead of being a closed cycle system, what it does is it takes up its own source of energy, which is liquid hydrogen, as opposed to relying on the sun for the source of energy.
Right.
And this liquid hydrogen is used by a fuel cell system, which just takes in ambient air as opposed to stored oxygen on the aircraft, and combines the air and the hydrogen to power the aircraft. So the duration of the aircraft is limited by how much liquid hydrogen you can carry on board.
It still uses solar electricity during the day.
No, it uses a fuel cell system.
All the time.
And you can mate it with a solar array as well, but that becomes optional. And this kind of configuration has a week to 3 weeks flight duration. And again, that's limited by how much liquid hydrogen you can carry on board the aircraft.
And then you have to refuel it, essentially.
Right. But still, that configuration, it can fly anywhere in the world. It still has a very low operating cost, a fraction of the cost of a conventional aircraft. And from a telecom perspective, anything over a week of flight duration provides a very robust, continuous presence from a logistics standpoint.
Okay, two more sort of physics or aerodynamic aeronautics questions. Is there enough, well, obviously there is, but explain how and why there is enough air in the stratosphere to support the lift that these vehicles need?
Yeah, that's a good question. The air gets significantly thinner as you move up in the stratosphere, and when we shattered the world altitude record by flying to 97,000 feet, I think most people didn't appreciate how challenging that was, but it gets exponentially more difficult as you move up in the stratosphere because of that thinning of the air. The propellers have to move faster and faster to move fewer and fewer molecules that are in the air to stay aloft.
Right.
And that's why this airframe is so unique. You know, its wingspan is almost 250 feet, but it weighs less than 2,000 pounds.
And the idea is that because it's so long, the lift is accumulated along its length?
Yes, so it has a very high lift coefficient for its weight.
And so under those circumstances, or with that airframe, there are enough air molecules to provide the lift.
And there are specially designed propellers as well that are optimized for operating in a very thin air environment.
Okay, now obviously there's no Orville or Wilbur Wright line flat on one of these to steer it around and to manage it. What's the system for communicating with the vehicle and controlling it from the ground?
It's all autonomous, and so you have a remote operator on the ground who actually, once this is deployed in like a mature telecom system environment, you have one ground operator that actually can oversee multiple robotic aircraft circling on station over top of the various markets.
You're saying they take care of themselves?
Right. They can even land by themselves in addition to change their flight pattern with changes in winds to maintain their station-keeping orbit, if you will.
They have little onboard computers to do all this?
Correct. The onboard computers, multiple redundancy as well, and on the ground, as well as there's a manual override for a pilot to operate it. But even the current aircraft that are undergoing prototype testing have very high levels of autonomy.
One of the typical ones of these, how much do they weigh and how much payload are they able to carry?
The production configuration will be just under 5,000 pounds, and this is the open cycle version that carries the liquid hydrogen, and so we'll have 10 to 14 days flight duration. And the payload carrying capacity is quite significant. It can carry up to about 500 pounds of payload capacity.
So essentially 10% of its weight.
Yeah, and but more importantly, if you look at it from a telecom perspective, the highest capacity broadband system we're looking at, for instance, right now, which would provide about 5 gigabits per second total throughput, that payload carrying capacity is on the order of about 300, 350 pounds. And so we actually have excess carrying capacity where we can add other type of payloads like broadcast payloads for TV signals, as well as even some remote sensing capabilities like imaging sensors for various applications like homeland security and wildfire detection even, which is obviously near and dear to our hearts here in Southern California.
Right. You can't stop it, but at least you can watch it, I guess.
Yeah, and that's what makes it a very powerful value proposition, because not only can this provide broadband at literally a fraction of the cost of satellites and without the delay that satellites have, but you can combine that broadband, low-cost broadband capability with these other high value added type applications like homeland security, monitoring coastlines and monitoring pipelines and critical infrastructure.
Okay, that gets to the question of where these are in the pipeline, so to speak. Are these machines up and running now, or are they about to, or are they still in development?
They're still in development. The different elements, the building blocks, if you will, have all been demonstrated now. We've flown the aircraft, we have multiple prototypes, flown the aircraft well above the planned 60 to 65,000 feet operating position for telecom missions. We've also developed the fuel cell systems and demonstrated their performance on the ground, simulating the operation in the stratosphere. The next key development piece for us is the development of the production intent airframe, integrating the fuel cell system and demonstrating that multi-day flight capability in the stratosphere. And so that's the development work that remains before we'll be deploying the first telecom services.
What's the timetable for that?
3 years, and that's driven by primarily this development of the airframe and integration of the production fuel cell system. And we're working closely with various government agencies like NASA and DOD for some of that funding, as well as ultimately from potential commercial partners as well for the telecom applications and other applications.
Do you have any competition in this space?
There are a variety of different initiatives that are being pursued. You know, for decades, people have always vied for operating in this stratospheric position because it had tremendous advantages over terrestrial applications, because it could replace hundreds, if not thousands, of cell sites on the ground.
Right.
As well as from a satellite perspective, it's 2,000 times closer to Earth than a geostationary satellite, so it doesn't have the time delay and has much higher bandwidth concentration.
Right.
On like a,
so it's sort of the best of both worlds. It reaches more of a space than any terrestrial tower, and it's not so attenuated as a satellite.
Right. Yeah, and also much cheaper than a satellite solution. So everybody's been vying for operating this position, but the trick has been to determine a way to both technically and economically, in a technical and economically viable fashion, be able to exploit the stratosphere, if you will. And AeroVironment is the world leader in this field. Nobody else has demonstrated the capabilities that we have. There are other initiatives that are being pursued. For instance, there are solar-powered airships with similar hybrid fuel cell systems as well for powering through the night.
By airship, you mean balloons?
Yeah, airships like blimps.
Right.
The challenge there, though, is the aerodynamic relationship is different for an airship, and to overcome the winds in the stratosphere, the airship needs a very large propulsion system, which drives the size of the airship larger, which gets you sort of into a catch-22 kind of.
Right.
And you ultimately need an airship that's over 1,000 feet in length, for instance, to operate over New York, for instance.
To give it enough stability to withstand the winds that it's subject to.
Right. And so that's probably one of the biggest technical challenges for various airship initiatives is determining a way that you could reliably station keep, which of course is critical for most telecom applications of interest.
Is your company working on those airship solutions?
Actually, we are working with other companies. For instance, with Lockheed, they're working on a military airship program that has much less stringent station keeping requirements, which is why it's feasible. And
it doesn't have to, so to speak, tread air.
Right. And so we're doing some aspects of the system development for Lockheed.
Now, is your company privately held, publicly held?
Yeah. Both AeroVironment, the parent company, is privately held, as well as this subsidiary Sky Tower that was set up specifically to pursue telecom applications enabled by the high-altitude aircraft technology. Sky Tower is also privately held.
Okay, but is it privately held 100% by AeroVironment?
Right now, Sky Tower is, but ultimately there could be multiple equity holders, especially from like strategic investors, which would be service providers throughout the world that are interested in using our technology. And we've had interest expressed from over 60 countries worldwide in Sky Tower for use in their countries.
Okay. What exactly is Helios?
Helios is the aircraft technology itself. So that's the high-altitude, long-duration aircraft that the parent company, AeroVironment, has developed that can be used for these multiple applications, including Sky Tower's telecom.
Okay. Now, Sky Tower, which was referred to in some of your literature as a 12-mile tower,
presumably right,
in relation to where the stratosphere is then the subsidiary of AeroVironment that's designed to add the telecommunications functions using the Helios extreme duration stratospheric UAV that AeroVironment has developed. Is that how
correct
it works? Okay. Say a little bit about the applications in third world versus, or what they're called now, developing countries versus developed countries, and what its potential is to bring communications infrastructure to places that don't even have electric infrastructure?
Sure, that's an excellent question. The our system is so novel and at such a low cost compared to conventional alternatives, it has a compelling value proposition both in developing countries as well as developed countries like the U.S. To help address the digital divide issues we even see here, for instance, in rural America,
right,
and even suburban areas outside of city centers.
Right.
But the strongest value proposition for this truly is in developing countries where either no infrastructure exists or very limited infrastructure. And if you can picture the system, which, you know, at a fraction of the cost of satellites, like you know, one-fifth or less the cost of a satellite system, you launch an aircraft and you have instant market coverage with a footprint that basically covers a city in the greater surrounding area. And so overnight you could provide state-of-the-art broadband communications to developing countries to help boost their economic development.
Now, does that how does that relate comparatively between cellular networks and broadband internet access?
Well, the architecture is essentially the same, which is if you're the end user, whether you're a fixed broadband user in a house, let's say, where because the airplane flies in a very tight turn radius, it appears geostationary from the ground.
Right.
So you'd have a simple dish antenna, very similar to a satellite TV dish, on your rooftop, but potentially smaller in size, that would provide this high bandwidth pipe from you to the aircraft down to a gateway station on the ground, which would be tied into a fiber optic backbone. Now, for a mobile voice or data application, it's a similar architecture, but instead of communications from your home or office building through a satellite-type dish, it would be through off-the-shelf handsets used for terrestrial wireless applications.
So in a sense, this is like the ill-fated Iridium, but instead of having to go all the way into low Earth orbit, it only has to go up to the stratosphere.
Right, and so we've already demonstrated the capabilities of this aircraft literally using off-the-shelf handsets. We've demonstrated third-generation mobile applications, voice, video, and data from an off-the-shelf Japanese mobile handset through our aircraft. And so what that does is that connects you, the end user, directly into a fiber optic backbone and eliminates any necessity for local backhaul requirements.
Where does the fiber optic connection fit in?
Well, in most metro cities, you typically have, you know, fiber connections between major cities.
Right.
But the issue becomes in the last mile, which is how do you connect the end user cost effectively and at high bandwidth to the rest of the network.
Right.
And that's essentially what SkyTower is. It's a last-mile solution that overcomes these cost and other obstacles facing other last-mile solutions.
Where does the how does the fiber optic node connect to the aircraft?
Well, since the aircraft's footprint is basically a city in the greater surrounding area,
right.
There's a lot of flexibility in where you locate that ground gateway station
right.
that the aircraft communicates with.
Oh,
so
okay.
You can co-locate that ground gateway station directly with a fiber optic backbone, a point of presence or POP, if you will.
So there's the fiber optic node has a transponder there on the ground, which connects to the aircraft.
Right.
And then the aircraft connects to everybody else.
Right. And so the aircraft is acting like a simple, it's using satellite terminology, it's a bent pipe repeater type
right.
system.
Or in a sense, it establishes a wide area network.
Right.
From itself. Where does, and with cellular, it essentially works the same way.
Correct.
Okay.
And, but one nice thing from a cellular perspective that this helps address is because this platform's footprint is so large, it replaces hundreds of cell sites on the ground. So one of the things this helps address, especially given the high look angle as well, meaning that you have excellent line of sight between a user on the ground and our aircraft.
Right.
But it helps overcome cell hell when you're transitioning from one cell site to another. You know, this is like one large cell that everybody's
right.
operating in.
Now do these cellular handsets and these fixed internet connections, do they need a lot of power to get back up to the satellite? I'm sorry, to get up to the plane?
No, the given that the clean line of sight, you're not powering through a lot of trees and other obstructions to communicate with the aircraft. So from a terrestrial perspective, it's not a significant amount of power to transmit out to 12 miles where our aircraft is. And that was something that we demonstrated during a telecom test in Hawaii in 2002. It was in collaboration with the Japan Ministry of Telecom. And we used an off-the-shelf NTT Docomo 3G mobile handset demonstrating that capability.
Can you give some kind of either absolute prices or relative prices as to how a less developed country would be able to deploy Sky Tower-based cellular or internet access system to large parts of its population?
Just to give you a comparison in terms of a service that we're very familiar with here. So if you were providing a DSL or cable-like service,
right.
We literally could provide that kind of service at a wholesale cost on the order of around $10 per month per subscriber.
Or about a third of what it costs now.
Right. Well, there's a difference between wholesale and retail costs. But still, yeah.
Half as much.
And from an infrastructure standpoint, to deploy our infrastructure, it's literally a fraction of the cost of trying to deploy cable and DSL-type infrastructure.
You don't have to tear up any streets, that's for sure.
Right. And so that's what also makes it appealing for developed markets, whether it's the U.S. or Europe or what have you. In addition to developing countries, is you don't have, from a time perspective and also from a cost perspective, these hurdles to deploying this kind of system.
Essentially, you can deploy it overnight.
Right. You launch a single airplane, and overnight you have instant state-of-the-art telecommunications. And for developing countries where not everybody could necessarily afford the customer premise equipment.
Right.
There could be kiosks similar to what they have right now for internet service provision. Those kiosks could have their own dish that communicates with our aircraft, which could provide bandwidth of up to 50 megabits per second or more through that pipe. And that service could be shared by multiple people in a village.
So right, so you could essentially have cyber cafes in these areas.
Correct.
Where people can come in. And of course, the network being what it is, once they're connected to the network, they're connected to the whole world.
Right, and taking that a step further, especially with developments in Wi-Fi and WiMAX, a very appealing role for SkyTower in a hybrid type network is if you look at a Wi-Fi system now, the most expensive portion of or cost in a Wi-Fi system is the backhaul, the connection to the fiber optic backbone.
Right.
Whether that's through DSL or T1 or even through a terrestrial wireless system.
Right.
Well, that backhaul connection can be provided by SkyTower. From the SkyTower system's perspective, that backhaul or Wi-Fi hotspot is just another broadband customer for SkyTower.
Right.
So you put a SkyTower transceiver at that Wi-Fi hotspot, and it eliminates the backhaul requirements from a terrestrial standpoint.
Which means you can put one of those in each village, and then you can put a Wi-Fi at that point and cover the rest of the village.
Right. And extending that further, you could then use WiMAX to extend the range further, either terrestrially, or you could even directly from a SkyTower service provide a WiMAX-like capability directly to end users. But there's some appeal in having a hybrid system because you can get further in-building penetration if you have this combination system, and there are higher frequency bands that are more suitable for SkyTower because you can provide much higher bandwidth at these higher frequency bands than you could with the 2.5 to 5 gigahertz that are typically used for Wi-Fi applications.
Okay, say a little bit more about WiMAX. I'm going to be talking to some people who run an experiment in Georgia recently using it. Is it kind of have a natural fit with SkyTower?
Yeah, it certainly could. The one of the advantages of a SkyTower system is, again, being like a 12-mile tall tower, your line of sight is much better than on the ground, so you have less interference from trees and buildings, and so it can provide excellent coverage, especially when you're looking for ubiquitous coverage from a system. So you can do that without having to deploy hotspots throughout a particular region.
So in fact, those Kalahari Bushmen who go out hunting the giraffe in the Elizabeth Marshall film could have their cell phones or their laptops with them and get pictures of giraffes,
right.
The latest giraffe meat market statistics and so on if they use WiMAX.
And so that makes that kind of application appealing, but what we haven't looked into too much is it being a system that operates in harmony with terrestrial systems, because of the visibility our system has, it's serving an entire city, for instance.
Right.
And so that would be providing very broad coverage using the same frequency bands that might be used for terrestrial WiMAX or Wi-Fi kind of application.
And is that a problem or an opportunity?
It could be both, but we haven't looked too much at these lower frequency bands like what are being used for Wi-Fi and WiMAX, just because we can get much higher capacity out of higher frequency bands and think that perhaps the most compelling application would be this sort of hybrid operation where SkyTower provides the backhaul connection for Wi-Fi and WiMAX.
Okay, and are you in active discussions with the providers of these other services?
We have ongoing dialogues in multiple countries with service providers, both terrestrial wireline and wireless services, as well as satellite providers.
Now, a lot of these applications, of course, require some kind of electricity down there on the ground. Are other parts of your company involved in projects that would bring photovoltaic generating capacity to villages that are otherwise off the grid?
Well, that's quite an interesting segue, because I happen to be involved in some of our other technologies as well. Where it, certainly photovoltaics is an option, but also wind and ocean power technologies could provide more cost-effective alternatives for providing that type of power as well.
And again, these are the kinds of systems that can work off the grid, or they can feed power back to the grid, or they could electrify a village.
Correct. So in some cases, there may be no grid if it's a developing region. And so this type of system is called a distributed generation system, where it's not connected to the grid, and it sort of creates its own very localized grid.
Right.
And through the combination of renewable energy source, whether it's the sun, wind, or wave, in combination with an energy storage type device, you can provide continuous power to that developing region.
Right. Now, these are not only cutting edge, but disruptive technologies to bring Parisian fashions and Silicon Valley technology to a place that's living in the Stone Age could have a disruptive effect on the power structure, on the lifestyles, on the mindset of everybody there. Does that come up in your work very much, or are you just still in the lab there working on the physics of all this and the engineering and building this, and that's going to be someone else's opportunity or problem to deal with that?
No, our focus is definitely more broad than just the engineering. We're very focused on the business, the opportunities, and the best way to deploy these for each local market region. And the ideal deployment scenario is where there's a compelling value proposition to that local market. So if it's a developing region, if they have interest in spurring economic development in that region, which in general improves the health and well-being of the citizens of that region, providing this kind of infrastructure, especially one that's lower cost, more rapidly deployable than conventional alternatives, is something that's of great appeal. And that's why we've had interest expressed from over 60 countries. And of those 60 countries, a lot of them are developing regions.
I was watching Charlie Rose show yesterday. It was a repeat of Ted Turner talking about things, and he has a vision that's very close to yours about using advanced technology through the United Nations to spur human development everywhere. Have you been talking to him at all?
Not with Ted Turner, but the UN has expressed strong interest in our platform as well. In fact, there was an initiative that was being run through the State Department in coordination with the United Nations. It's called a Peace Wing Initiative, where very central to this Peace Wing Initiative would be Helios-based platforms that could provide things from disaster management for natural disasters, providing the eye in the sky assessment and emergency communications, in addition to just providing basic needs like everyday low-cost voice, video, and data type services.
Okay. Was all of this envisioned in the original AeroVironment vision, or has it been evolving along with the technology?
Well, in general, if you look at the broad range of things that AeroVironment has done, including a replica of a flying pterodactyl,
right.
Which on the surface you'd say, why did AeroVironment do that? Well,
right.
Actually, it turns out that some of the avionics that were developed for the pterodactyl ultimately made their way into our high-altitude, long-duration aircraft as well.
Right.
So not everything's intentional, but organically over time, these various technologies have helped enable very special things like what we've been discussing. And the concept from a telecom perspective is something that we have championed for over two decades. And what's interesting, and then this typically happens with leading-edge technologies, which we're very embraced with, and how do you go about pursuing market opportunities enabled by them. But initially, it's a difficult process. It's an education process demonstrating that this technology is truly viable. And it actually wasn't until we started operating platforms in the stratosphere that interest picked up significantly in this, especially from a telecom perspective, because I think before then, to a lot of people, this was just science fiction.
Right. Well, so was the telephone and computers at one point. Are you personally or the company in this for the money, the glory, or the good you can do, or some combination thereof?
I would say it's a combination thereof. You know, it's interesting, even the name of the parent company, AeroVironment, that sort of combines aerospace or high tech with environment.
Right.
A lot of things we do have a strong positive environmental bent to them. Electric vehicles, electric bicycles, solar powered airplanes, distributed generation that's solar powered. We've been involved in wind energy. We were since the 70s. In fact, a lot of the wind farms that you see in California, we were involved in one shape or form with most of those farms that have been developed.
Right.
So I think it's a combination of multiple factors, but certainly I think there's an underlying theme that we want to make the world a better place with the technologies we develop.
Okay. Any final things that you think the listeners should know about AeroVironment?
Well, I would say if listeners are interested in learning more about Sky Tower AeroVironment, I'd encourage them to look at our websites, which aren't always updated as much as we'd like, but it has a lot of the core information that we've been talking about, and that would be www.skytowerglobal.com. And www.aerovironment.com.
Spell AeroVironment.
That's AeroVironment.com.
Okay, I'll put links up to both of those right underneath this conversation.
Okay, well, I appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate your talking to us. Thank you very much. And I look forward to, as soon as we get some video capability here, maybe getting some images of some of these things that we've been talking about as well.
Yeah, we certainly could do that, and also I will email to you a few images if of interest.
That's good. We'll put those up, too.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.